It's hard for me to remember a time in my life when I was not familiar with Psalm 119, verses 9 through 11, and did not know the song, "How Shall the Young Secure Their Hearts?" Growing up, going to Athens Bible School as a child, I think that every school year that began on the first day of the year, that song was led. And I don't know if that was the decision of Cliff Buchanan or A.J. Rawlings or who it might have been, but yet I know that there were people there who were interested in the spirituality of young people. And that is so true in so many places, and that is so true here at Gooch Lane. This past weekend has been testimony to that. Friday night, Brent and Becky Romine volunteered their time to come and to teach separate classes for young men and women dealing with the idea of spirituality from Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego and the example they set. Yesterday, we had a very good series of lessons presented by Jason Shackelford, who told us of his journey to Jesus from the world. Larry Rouse, who told us his journey to Jesus from religious error. And Steve Klein, who told us about his journey to Jesus from a Christian home. And I told Pam on the way home, I don't think that young people could have heard a better series of lessons yesterday that illustrated the different walks that these men came from, their confrontation with Jesus, and how that confrontation turned out. Good lessons. And this morning, what I would like to do is to continue those ideas for at least one more time, and that's to talk about young lights in the world. With a number of people who are concerned about young people. This morning I want to focus a lesson primarily to our young people. Now, if you are no longer in that age category, your time I don't think is going to be wasted. There are lessons that we're going to talk about that will be true no matter what stage of life we're in, no matter what age we are. But I want to particularly talk to our younger crowd today. I want to talk to you, to those of you who are not Christians. I want to talk to you to those of you who are Christians, who perhaps need to be pursuing things a little bit harder, to encourage you, to edify and admonish you in your walk in the Lord. And I want to begin this morning by doing that in talking about when the Lord opens a door for you. If you will, look over to the book of Colossians with me, to chapter 4, just briefly. And as we look, this is a passage that I hope to come back to later and spend a little more time with. But just to listen this morning to the words of the Apostle Paul as he spoke to the Colossians. And he said to them in verse 3, chapter 4, verse 3, he says, "At the same time, pray also for us that God may open to us a door for the Word to declare the mystery of Christ, on account of which I am in prison." That idea of the Lord opening doors is a tremendous thought. And I don't care who we are, at what point in life we are, if we are good stewards of the Lord, He is constantly opening doors for us. He's constantly giving us opportunities. And what I'd like to do is to talk very briefly in the first part of our lesson this morning about three young men to whom a door was opened, rather unusual doors that were opened. So many men and women we could look at in the Bible, but consider with me this morning one that we know a whole lot about, and perhaps two that we don't know quite as much about, but to consider the door that God opened to them, and the first of those young people being the man Joseph. I imagine, for those who have grown up in Christian homes, that the story of Joseph is perhaps one of, if not the most familiar account of the Old Testament. It's an account that we talk about so often in our Bible classes and sermons, just simply because God tells us so much about this young man and he has such an exemplary life. But this morning I want to think about the door that's open to him, and I want you to think about him before that door was opened. He was a young man who was actually placed in a very difficult, that turned out to be a very dangerous situation. Jacob was a good man. God testifies to that within the Word. But Jacob had problems with his parenting skills. He showed favoritism. And that favorite was Joseph, as we know. That favoritism, in turn, brought on the hatred of his brothers. And it may be that Joseph contributed a bit to that, as he told on his brothers when they did things perhaps they shouldn't have been doing. But whatever the case, we've got a rather dysfunctional family situation. A father who's showing undue attention to one son and that bringing on the bitterness of others. And it's in this scenario that Joseph is going to have that door open to him. But that door is a most unusual door. And in fact, we could say that door, first of all, opens up to a roller coaster ride, where Joseph is going to be taken to very low levels and he'll kind of inch his way back up only to go back down again. And you remember some of those things. He's sold to a band of slave traders. His brothers lie to his father about him that he's dead. He's sent to the land of Egypt where he's put in a pretty good situation for a slave, but yet the master's wife destroys that. He's put into prison with the hope that he's going to get out shortly, but a short-term memory causes that not to happen. And so he's up and down through all of this. And I imagine for a young man, this was so discouraging and so alarming to him. But yet as we look at Joseph, we understand that through all of this, from what the Lord tells us, he kept the appropriate attitude. And I think that is brought out so clearly when he's having all of this trouble with Potiphar's wife, and he says to her, "He is not greater in the house than I am, nor is he," talking about Potiphar here, "nor has he kept back anything from me except you, because you are his wife." And then I want you to listen to this statement. "How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And the answer to his question is, "I can't. I'll not have anything to do with this." And so Joseph took a stand and he found that a door was open to him where he rose to prominence in the household of Pharaoh, to prime minister of the land. And God used him then to protect and to preserve his people. But here's the point that I want you to see from this. When that door was opened for Joseph, Joseph's earthly family could not prevent him from going through that door. No matter how difficult those brothers made life for him, taking away the security of a household with a father who loved him so, that earthly family could not prevent him from going through the door and doing what the Lord desired. Let's talk very briefly about one more man. We look to another of the Old Testament young men, and this was a man by the name of Josiah. And if you want to, go ahead and be turning back to 2 Chronicles chapter 34 as we talk about this young man, and we'll look at a few verses concerning his life here in just a minute. But I want to talk to you a little bit about his background, because he too came from a dysfunctional family. Here, Josiah was born into a line of kings. His father was 16 years old when Josiah was born. We think about teen parents, he had one. And his father died when Josiah was only 8 years old. So in that time, I don't know how much association he had with his father, but nonetheless, we know his father was a wicked man, and so it couldn't have been good, even if there was time together. But I want to note a very striking contrast between father and son. At 16, his father Ammon is wicked. Let's notice what's going on with Josiah at age 16. If you look here in 2 Chronicles chapter 34 and look to verse 3, it says, "In the 8th year of his reign," so he's 8 years old when he starts reigning, we're 8 years later, so he's 16 years old, "while he was yet a boy, he began to seek the God of David, his father." What a contrast. Here was his father Ammon, who was killed because of wickedness, and here is his son, who at age 16 is saying, "I am now ready to seek God. I want to be right with Him." And it's so interesting, the text tells us when he was still a youth, when he was still a boy, we would say, while he was still a kid, he said, "I've got things that I know are important to do." And what do we find then? That he's going to spend his reign fighting worldliness. We're going to find that throughout his reign, there are those who are wanting to bring the world into Judah, and he is trying his best to keep it out. If we continue in verse 3, it says, "In the 12th year He began to purge Judah and Jerusalem of the high places, the Asherim and the carved and the metal images. And they chopped down the altars of the Baals in his presence. And he cut down the incense altars that stood above them. And he broke in pieces the Asherim and the carved and the metal images. And he made dust of them and scattered it over the graves of those who had sacrificed to them. And it goes on and talks about more that he did. But here was Josiah. He was an idol-destroying machine. If there was an idol anywhere around, he was going to have it obliterated, chopped up, turned into dust, burned, thrown in the ash heap. It didn't matter because he understood what that was doing to his people, and he wanted that completely out. And I think what we learn from this young man who began to seek the Lord when he was very much still a kid, that worldliness cannot prevent one from going through a door that the Lord opens. When the world is your enemy, when it's trying to press in against you, you can fight against that and you can say, I will not let this stop me. Let's look at one more man. We've seen Joseph and we've seen Josiah. And another young man by the name of Jeremiah shows us something also. Go ahead and turn over to Jeremiah chapter 1. And as you're turning there, understand that Jeremiah, we don't know what his age was, but we know that he was still a kid himself. When the Lord comes to him and says, I've got work for you to do. And Jeremiah was very unsure of himself. And perhaps that's what made him a man that God could work with. He was not haughty and arrogant and freely admitted to the Lord the doubts that he had and the fears that he had. And if you look in chapter 1, beginning in verse 4, we find the word of the Lord came to me saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. And before you were born, I consecrated you. I appointed you a prophet to the nation. Now listen to his words. Then I said, ah, Lord God, behold, I do not know how to speak, for I am only a youth. But the Lord said to me, do not say, I am only a youth. For to all to whom I send you, you shall go. And whatever I command you, you shall speak. Do not be afraid of them, for I am with you to deliver you, says the Lord. Here was Jeremiah who was so afraid, who was so scared, and he says, Lord, send anybody else but me. I'm just a kid. I can't handle it. The Lord said, don't give me that excuse. I know exactly who you are. And I have work for you to do. And then he tells us at the end of verse 8, the only thing that Jeremiah needed to know is when the Lord said, I am with you. I am with you. When I am with you, you don't have to be scared. You don't have to be frightened. And what Jeremiah shows us is that when the Lord opens the door, fear cannot prevent one from going in. Even though you may not feel capable, even though you may not feel like you're the one, if God says the door is open to you, you don't let fear keep you out. And so here's Joseph who shows us a dysfunctional family can't keep you out. A family can't keep you from going through the door. Josiah who shows us worldliness cannot prevent you from going through that door. Jeremiah showing us that fear cannot prevent you from going through that door. And so with those three young men in mind, let me bring the lesson down a little closer to us. There are dangers for all of us that when the Lord opens a door, we allow someone to lock it for us. Joseph could have very easily done that. Don't you agree? That Joseph could have said to the Lord, you've forgotten about me. I'm in this dark prison cell. You think Josiah could have allowed that door to be locked? Lord, I come from a wicked father. I'm just a kid myself. The land is full of idols. Jeremiah could have said, I don't want to go to these people. I know what they're like. I'm around them. Any one of them could have allowed those doors to be locked. And what you and I, really no matter what our age, but I want especially our younger folks to think about it this morning, is that you've got to be very careful that you don't allow your own feelings or people around you and their feelings to lock the door for you. So let's think about some examples of where that can happen. And the first one may sound rather odd, but we can allow family to lock that door for us. That sounds strange, speaking in a place that is primarily made up of Christian parents who are seeking to raise Christian kids. But I want us all to understand, both kids and parents alike, that if we are not awfully careful, we can lock that door for young people. And let me explain what I mean by that. Sometimes overprotectiveness can lock a door. We know that if we are in middle to upper class American society, that we have a very, very big interest in keeping every kid safe. Now, I'm not going to ask anybody to raise your hand, but I would be very interested to know if there's anyone who's over 40 here who ever heard of a helmet with a bicycle when you were a kid. You know, that's something that's new. I even read in the past 2 weeks that there are schools that are banning dodgeball because it's hurting kids' self-esteem when they get hit and they're put out. We are a protective society in kind of the middle and upper echelons of it. And maybe some of that is okay, but the problem is that what we can do is allow that to become such an important thing to us that we try to insulate and perhaps even isolate our children so that they get the feeling that they are living in such a safe world that sin's not really that big a deal. We try to keep them away from all of these different things that are bad. And they become very confused because they're living in a world where maybe at church they hear about sin, but really not anywhere else. That's a mistake. And the reason that's a mistake can be found in the first line of a verse that's given by the prophet Ezekiel when he says, "The soul who sins shall die." We have to, as parents, have to be cautious about how we approach this. We don't want our kids exposed too much too quickly. But yet, if what we're seeking to do is to keep them so isolated and insulated that they don't really have a good understanding of what sin is, this is a problem. And to our young people, you need to understand that if you don't have an idea of what sin is, that's going to be a problem in ever coming to grips with the fact that you are a sinner. Parents, I think sometimes as well, very much in love, but a misguided love, seek to protect their kids against any kind of failure. I don't know if we have any in here. I doubt it. But I have seen kids who are so smothered by a parent, or perhaps the parents, that there is no room for failure in that child's life. And a child makes a bad mark on a test, and the parent is up there to argue the case for the child. And maybe the child's having difficulty with a friend, and the parent's over at the friend's house and with his parents. And what happens is, what should naturally be a building process to teach a young person how to deal with failure is taken away. So how can that be a problem for you young people? I think it's the problem in the fact that at times you don't have a good sense of sin's consequences. That sin is one of those things you've heard about at church. But yet when you're confronted with it and you start to have to deal with it because you've been so isolated and so protected and your parents have kept you from failure, it's very easy to fall to it because A, you don't view yourself as a sinner, and B, you don't view this as detrimental to your soul. That's a danger. And I think if we're not awfully careful, even with the most noble efforts that families put in, we can allow this to happen to our young people, and young people can allow it to happen to themselves. So what do we do? Well, we have a lot, really, of our tweens and our teens who are not Christians, who have not made that commitment to Christ. There's not an age where you say, you are there. You know what to do. This is the time to do it. But there does come a point when you need to start realizing what sin does and what sin is and what that means eternally. And I think the Apostle Paul makes that so clear when he says in Romans chapter 5 and verse 10, "For if while we were enemies of God," do we understand that idea of being an enemy? We're on the other side. And so if I have lived in a society that seeks to protect everything, in a house that seeks to protect me in every way, I've got to lay all of that aside and come to terms with the fact that if I have not committed myself to God, and I am aware of what that does to my soul, and I know what salvation is all about, it's time. There's no putting it off. Because as Ezekiel goes on to tell us, a parent is not going to bear the sins of the son, nor is the son going to bear the sins of the parent. The idea is we stand before God with our life, and we're judged accordingly. So we cannot allow this to stand in our way. Like Josiah, we also can't allow worldliness to stand in our way. And I may take a sharp right turn on you here if you expect me to go in a certain way with this. Because the kind of worldliness I want to talk about is the kind of worldliness where we are letting the world create our calendar. Maybe some of you have a program on your computer that creates a calendar for you, and you put in all of the data that you want, and it draws it out very perfectly. Let me tell you, in a sense, the world really wants to do that to you. The world wants to draw your calendar for you. And the danger of this is not badness. It's not that you're saying, oh, I'm going to go out and do this sinful thing on Friday night, and this sinful thing on Saturday night. It's not that. It's the idea that the world is so seeking, and the devil behind this world is so seeking, to smother out any attention that you're going to give to God, that before long, you know who's in control. And it's not that the devil really wants to take all of that out. He is quite happy for you to have a little God time. He's quite happy for you to be here this morning as long as this is it. And maybe even tonight, as long as that's it, and nothing else God-like is going to be on your calendar, as long as it's filled with long practices at the ball field and going somewhere and taking trips and doing all of this, as long as that's got your full attention, he doesn't care anything about this. And so what happens? Let me make a point from Josiah. Josiah's people, and I know this for a fact because it's seen in the reigns of other kings, they would have been quite happy if Josiah had said, "Worship Jehovah along with your other gods." If you've got room on your shelf, if you've got your idol to Baal and you've got your Asherah pole out in the yard, and you've got a little room for Jehovah, everything's okay. There would have been a lot of people from Judah who would have been very happy for that to have happened. But Josiah said, "I am not letting anything crowd out the Lord. I'm not allowing anything to get in the way." And so in a very general sense, I'd like for you to think about that in relation to your time. Not that you've got to spend 24 hours a day with a Bible open and nothing else, but the fact that Jehovah is the only God in your life. It's not a soccer ball or a baseball or a basketball or cross-country tennis shoes. It's not club membership. Nothing else is allowed to be anywhere remotely close to God in what you're giving your priorities to. And I would encourage you very much to think about what the Apostle Paul said. As he said in chapter 5, verses 15 and 16, "Look carefully then how you walk, not as unwise, but as wise, making the best use of the time," or redeeming the time. You got to use your time effectively. That's what it's all about. I've had a lot of dealings with a lot of young people. And as I look back over the 2 decades plus that I have, I know that there are some of those young people who got involved in drug abuse. Some of them, it destroyed their lives. Some of them got over it. I know kids who became very involved in alcoholism, I know kids who were fornicating and they had children as a result of that. But I want to tell you, the biggest killer of spirituality that I have seen in 20 years is the point that I'm making right here. It's people who said, God is okay, and I'm going to give Him a little, but He's not everything. And He is not the center of my life. Because when you have that attitude, even if you keep filling a bench, your heart is far from Him. And this aspect of worldliness can kill, I think, much more so than these other things that typically we associate with it. And then Jeremiah shows us that a potential door locker is the idea of fear. Fear can be a very good motivator. Fear can also be something that'll destroy. There are some people who are so scared that they'll spend their life cowering in the shadows because they're unwilling to get involved in something in which they might fail. That's a danger, I think, for all of us, isn't it? Probably many of you, like me, can think of things that you wish you had done in your childhood, but you're just timid and fearful for doing it. But let me break this idea of fear up into two categories. I think, first of all, there's undue fear. Let me describe what I mean by this. I think this is something that primarily affects young men because they think, in a very immature way, but yet nonetheless the fear is there. If I become a Christian, they're going to ask me to lead prayer. Larry Vincent is going to come and he's going to ask me to participate in this young men's service, and he's going to expect me to speak, or he's going to expect me to lead a song. Now, as adults, we can kind of tut at that and say, well, what a silly reason. Let me tell you, if you teach a speech class, you understand that fear of being in public can be a real thing. There are some people who never get over that. I want to tell our young men, I love to see you up here. I think it's good. We need young men who are learning those skills. But if you never lead a song in front of a congregation, that's not going to keep you out of heaven. If you never lead a public prayer, that's not going to minimize your relationship with God. And if you are thinking and you are so carried away by this fear that it's drawn all of these ideas into your mind that I'm going to get up there and they're going to ask me to lead a song and it's going to go flat and nobody's going to sing along and I'm going to give a talk and I'm going to lose my notes and you let all of these fears roll around in your head, you have no idea what salvation is about. Because salvation is the peace that you're making with God. And salvation is not saying, okay, now you're initiated, now you can stand in front of a congregation. It's saving your soul. So don't allow those undue fears in your mind to keep you from a decision that's so important. Let me say this. Some of those fears are quite real. And the Lord makes this point quite clearly. I want you to go with me over to 1 Corinthians chapter 2. I can't remember when exactly I came across this passage, but it so changed my view of the Apostle Paul, because I, for many years, almost thought of the Apostle Paul as kind of the super Christian. He was the man who had everything right, everything going well. And then I found these verses. And he says in verse 1, "And I came to you, brothers, I did not come proclaiming to you the testimony of God with lofty speech or wisdom. For I decided to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and Him crucified." And then listen to verse 3. "And I was with you in weakness and in fear and in much trembling. And my speech and my message were not in plausible words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power, that your faith might not rest in the wisdom of men, but in the power of God." Those are not words that I had ever associated with the Apostle Paul before. Trembling? Fear? There are times when Christianity is tough business, and don't let anybody tell you otherwise. And what we find are there are occasions that can be specifically hard for younger people. And I think one of those is the fear of a friend's reaction. That's real. That's real at any age we're in. There are people who are 40, 50, 60 years old who become Christians and their friends turn on them. But that can happen as a youth also. And many times in our youth, that's something very big on our minds. And I'm not going to tell you it won't happen, but I will tell you this, Jesus never asked anything of you that He Himself did not experience. I think about John chapter 15 and verse 18, where He's talking to His disciples and He says, "If the world hates you, know that it has hated Me before it hated you." You ever just let that soak in? God's creation turned on Him. The one who gave them life, they now hated. And He says to His disciples, don't be surprised. If they hate you, just remember they hated Me before they hated you. That fear is real. And I think another very real fear that we can have is that I just can't live up to it. If I become a Christian, there's going to be things expected of me, and I've got to live up to that standard. Well, yes, there are things expected. But I'm going to tell you something. If any of us have to live up to that standard on our own, we're all in trouble. And that's why God says, while you are trying your best, you remember, I'm a gracious and I'm a merciful God. I'm a God who's not there to destroy you. I'm a God who's there to help you when you're trying to be what I want you to be. And so I want you to understand, if you're allowing that kind of fear to plague you, just go back to Jeremiah. And when Jeremiah was trying to say that, the Lord said, please be quiet. I'm with you. You don't need to know anything else. I'm with you. I'll deliver you. And with that, that fear can be diminished. And you can walk with your God. So what does all of this mean for us? Well, as we think about what was read, I believe there's just two or three things we need to remember from Psalm 119. Seek God with all your heart. Don't let other things get in the way. Don't let your activities become your God and your idol. Seek Him with all of your heart. And the psalmist says, store up His Word. And if I can offer you this admonition, don't be apathetic toward the study of God's Word. When we are, well, really at any age, we've got things that are pressing on us that can take this time away, but in our youth, sometimes we can excuse ourselves with the very misguided notion, I've got lots of time to learn the Bible. I'm going to tell you, the things I remember best are the things I remembered in my that I learned in my youth. When you're young, your brain is functioning at its optimal level. It's absorbing. It's going to be ingrained. It's put in your long-term memory. And as you get older, you don't stop studying, but those things start becoming more difficult to remember. I'm sure you've heard this before, but you're going to hear it at least one more time. You live in an area where you are so blessed with ample opportunities to learn. And sometimes we can allow the ample opportunities to kind of make us grow apathetic. It's kind of comparing someone who's starving to death with someone who feasts every night. If you have a man who's starving to death, you'll see him going to almost any lengths to find something to eat and eating things that you would never dream of eating otherwise. Whereas on the other hand, someone who's got a refrigerator full of food becomes quite picky and quite finicky and will only eat certain things. We can allow that to happen to us. But I want you to think about all of the opportunities that you have. We think about even this past weekend, class Friday night, a morning of learning yesterday. We think about the devotionals that are offered every month. We think about the Bible classes on Sunday morning and Wednesday night. We think about the young men's services that are lined up and men like Larry who give their time and their devotion to make these work. There are people who are interested in you, but they cannot help you unless you're interested in the things they want to teach you. And so I strongly encourage you that in your youth, you don't spurn these opportunities. You use them to your fullest advantages. And if you hear of other congregations that are having devotionals and Bible studies, you take part in those. And yes, it may cause you to give up something in the short term that sounds very fun. I imagine yesterday, I didn't do any polling, but I imagine some of the kids who were here because their parents said, you need to be there. And there might have been other things that could have been done, but yet I also imagine there were kids here who said, I want to be here because this is a good opportunity. And we had a number of young people who visited from other congregations who came in to join in this study. That's the kind of attitude that you need. That's how you store the Word up in your heart. And once that Word is stored up, you let that Word be your guard. What's the reason for the classes and the devotionals and the sermons and the Bible studies? It's so that when these temptations come along, when the Lord has opened a door for you, you don't say, sorry, Lord, no thanks. I'm not going through that door. So if you are young, as the Apostle Paul told Timothy, let no one despise your youth, but don't you despise it either. Don't say as Jeremiah, Lord, get somebody else. I can't do it. If the Lord has opened the door, you can do it. Why? Because you're a great person? Because the Lord is with you. That's what he told Jeremiah, and that's what he tells us. And so I ask to our young people who are not Christians, to our young people maybe who aren't being quite as active as they need to be, are you letting your light shine? Are you allowing these doors that the Lord opens to you to be avenues where you can teach your friends, where you can build up and uplift others, where you can help people? Or are these doors that are going to be closed and locked out of fear, out of overprotection, out of worldliness? These are the things I want you to consider.